did 18th century British myths and fantasies about indigenous people in the Americas inform and shape the growth of its financialized empire? In this episode of the Counter Speculations audio tour, originally recorded at the base of a statue of Queen Anne, which stands in front of St. Paul's Cathedral, Robbie Richardson explains.
This audio tour explores the relationship of finance capital and the imagination through some of the landmarks and histories of the City of London, the square mile inside the old city walls that, for centuries, has represented a center of British and global capitalism. Most of the audio you will hear was recorded during a physical tour held on April 14th, 2018.
In this recording, you'll hear Robbie Richardson present on North American Indians and British Modernity. Richardson is a lecturer in 18th century literature at the University of Kent and a member of the Pabano First Nations in what is currently Canada.
This audio tour is a presentation of the Urban Laboratory at University College London and the Reimagining Value Action Lab at Lakehead University in Canada. To learn more or to find the interactive map, please visit www.ucl.ac.uk/urbanlab.
Hello, everybody. My name is Robbie Richardson. And I think that my intervention today might be of a slightly different nature, but I hope you'll bear with me in the spirit of Jameson to always historicize. I'm a lecturer in 18th century literature, so this is my my approach. So just, I'm going to read sort of a thing here just to rein myself in, but just briefly to say something about this site. You know, we were talking a little bit before about, you know, religion and the imagination. Well, this site was where the last public execution took place in front of St. Paul's. And it was a member of the gunpowder plot who was killed. So it was this kind of site of Catholic martyrdom and kind of Protestant fetishism. And so to build this monument to Queen Anne, the last great Stuart monument, on this exact site is sort of a provocation, obviously, towards that. I don't know if you know about Queen Anne, but she was the last Stuart ruler. Her father, James II, was deposed in 1688 for being a Catholic, effectively. And after that, which was the Glorious Revolution, many suggest that the Glorious Revolution gave rise to capital as we understand it, because it changed property law and all these sorts of things. So that's just sort of the broader context of this. You might also notice that this is actually a replica of the original statue. So the original one was built in 1712. And then after a lot of damage, I'll talk a bit about that, it was rebuilt in 1886. And you'll notice that on the other side, it says the name of the sculptor, who was Francis Bird, the original sculptor. It does not say the name of the Victorian sculptor on this side. And the reason was is that he was in prison at the time that this was completed for a series of financial crimes. So quite a wonderful coincidence that I actually only discovered recently as I was sort of reading a bit more about the statue. So I'm just going to talk about this figure of America here, the sort of menace and subordination. You'll notice that the head of the European beneath her foot. So here we go. So here, prominently placed in front of Christopher Wren's St. Paul's, which was itself declared by Parliament to be complete in 1711, although they spent millions more over the next two decades on it. But, you know, Parliament said it was complete, so it was complete. So this is the 1886 replica of the statue of Queen Anne, completed in 1712, but not revealed until 1713. For almost a year, it stood covered in a wooden hoarding so that it could be unveiled following a Thanksgiving service in St. Paul's, celebrating the Treaty of Utrecht at the end of the costly War of the Spanish Succession. Now, the War of the Spanish Succession drew Britain into massive debt. Like, it was colossal debt. And the treaty gave them a series of things which I'll talk about. So Queen Anne herself, incidentally, could not attend because she had horrible gout, which she was famous for. So the treaty gave Britain Gibraltar, as well as Menorca, but more importantly, Britain in 1713 gained Newfoundland, the area around Hudson's Bay, and Acadia, of course owned by the French. And we can see this Indian as the sort of stand-in for those triumphs. So this monument is the first ever outdoor monument which connects Britain with its extra-European empire. So this, in and of itself, is an imaginative project of empire. and a uniquely first one. Empire, of course, was not yet a material reality at this time, but rather more of an imaginative project, which indeed it stayed that way. This period also speaks to an important period of self-imagining for Britain. The Acts of Union in 1707 joined Scotland and England, which created this sort of new layered sense of Britishness. The Bank of England was formed in 1694, just 20 years earlier. The South Sea Company, that of the famous South Sea Bubble, a decade later was formed in 1711, just 2 years before this. And the rise of the public sphere in London coffee houses all around here, incidentally, as well as the proliferation of the print trade with the rise of fiction, brought the imagination in close proximity to these developments. Some have suggested that the rise of finance and public credit are deeply connected to the rise of the novel and the narrative imagination. And this, again, is the sort of perhaps speculative imagination. And incidentally, St. Paul's Churchyard was the center of the London book trade for 150 years, even by this time. So interesting, part of the reason that this statue was replaced in 1886 was due to the heavy damage that multiple attacks had upon it. At least two reputed lunatics attacked the statue in the mid-1700s. And one who attacked all four figures ripped off the arms of the queen and was found running with the orb in his hand. He was a Lascar, a South Asian sailor from the East India Company. And this is in the 1760s, and he was later sent to Bedlam. That is his intervention in Empire. So Anne looks severely upward to her right with her orb and scepter in hand. Some suggest it looks like she's poking a cheese gout, you know. Her back is to the church. And as one critic wrote and later scrawled on this side across the base, brandy-faced Nan, who was left in the lurch, with her face to the gin shop, her back to the church. And indeed, there was a notable gin shop just over there. So around her are four allegorical figures. We can't see them all from this angle, but there's France on the far side, Britannia, Ireland, and America. Britain, of course, did not rule France at this time, nor America. Hence the imaginative project. But British monarchs claimed dominion over the French up to the French Revolution, after which obviously it didn't seem very prudent to. So of these four figures, the one, of course, I want to focus on is this figure of America, a mixed bag of savage significations that reflected important imaginative constructions of the time. She is seen as the allegorical figure of America had often been seen, topless, and with a feathered headdress, bow and arrow in hand. The arrow, of course, now is missing. I don't know what happened to that one, but. She's both innocent and menacing, with her nakedness balanced by her weapons, and perhaps most troublingly, by the severed head of a European beneath her foot, and the strange lizard creature, which at the time was described as an alligator. There weren't any alligators around here, so. So while this indigenous American is allegorical and undifferentiated, it doesn't reflect any specific material reality of indigenous people, except perhaps Brazil's indigenous people, the Taino, who did have feathered headdresses and skirts and were depicted by the Portuguese hundreds of years earlier, so that kind of influenced this. But at the same time, there are important context, real context, to this inclusion that are tied to an emergent Britain as a global trading force. She, the Indian, represents the geographic and resource gains of the Treaty of Utrecht, but also, as I hope to show, much more ambivalent gains and legacies that are connected to empire. So in 1710, 3 years prior to the unveiling of the statue, four representatives of the Haudenosaunee, or the Iroquois Confederacy, visited London and had an audience with Queen Anne. They had their portraits painted, were followed around as they visited the sites of London, including St. Paul, where there's a famous essay by Addison which talks about them seeing St. Paul and thinking it's carved out of a whole piece of rock, for whatever reason. And they also went to Bedlam as well, incidentally. And they were discussed by writers in both high and low press, which again had proliferated since the development of trade publishing in the 1680s. So this visit by these four members of the Haudenosaunee was remembered throughout the 18th century and was truly a sort of multimedia event of the day. And in fact, there's accounts of people selling prints of them in St. Paul's Churchyard. So we could sort of visualize that, if you will. So it also provided British people with a self-imaginary of themselves as a wealthy cosmopolitan nation, which I will now demonstrate. So this is most apparent in Alexander Pope, if you don't know the one of the preeminent poets of the 18th century. Alexander Pope's poem, Windsor Forest, which, like the statue, was written in celebration of the Treaty of Utrecht, in the same spirit as the statue. Near the end of the poem, Pope evokes the recent visit of the Indian kings, while at the same time imagining the Thames as the world's river, when he writes, "The time shall come when free as sea or wind, unbounded Thames shall flow for all mankind. Whole nations enter with each swelling tide, and seas but join the regions they divide. Earth's distant ends our glory shall behold, and the new world launch forth to seek the old. Then ships of uncouth form shall stem the tide, and feathered people crowd my wealthy side. Naked youths, painted chiefs admire our speech, our color, our strange attire." So the Thames stands in for a kind of Whiggish historical progress flowing from commerce between nations, and indicates for a desire for the world produced by merchants. So the commercial world becomes the desirable world. This Indian, and the Indian generally in this context that I'm speaking of, is the imaginative possibility of a world of non-isolated nations begging for the clothes, literally, and wares of Europe. So with this spread of wealth comes liberty. And Pope continues, and this is where it gets fraught. "Oh, stretch thy reign, fair peace, Utrecht, from shore to shore, till conquest cease and slavery be no more, till the freed Indians in their native groves reap their own fruits and woo their sable loves. Peru once more a race of kings behold, and other Mexicos be roofed with gold." So the Treaty of Utrecht opened up the possibility, according to Pope, of Britain as a global superpower, and one which could free Indians from Spanish colonial lands. And yet, perhaps the most important clause in the Treaty of Utrecht was the asiento. This was the contract that gave a nation, or in some cases a corporation, full monopoly over the slave trade to Spanish America. The Treaty of Utrecht gave Britain the asiento for 30 years, allowing them to transport 5,000 Africans to the Spanish per year. Thus, the Indian in Pope and the Indian here effaces the enslaved Africans that were the actual reality of the Treaty of Utrecht. The gains of African lives cannot be represented in this sort of celebration of empire. So another important influence of the statue to consider is the story of Inkle and Yeriko, which is one of the most popular fictional narratives of the 18th century, and an early fable of merchant capitalism. So Inkle and Yeriko was first popularized in 1711, right around this time, obviously, and represents some of the anxieties surrounding the merchant's world, which was becoming increasingly hegemonic in the fiction of the early century. Think Robinson Crusoe, Moll Flanders, etc. So Inkle and Yeriko tells the story of a young merchant adventurer named Thomas Inkle. Inkle's father made sure, and I'm quoting from the book, to instill in his son an early love of gain by making him a perfect master of numbers, and consequently giving him a quick view of loss and advantage, and preventing the natural impulses of his passions by preposition towards his interests. He's the stone-cold capital subject. His perfectly formed merchant mind is shipwrecked. Was shipwrecked on the American coast, and Inkle is rescued by a beautiful young Indian woman who's described as looking almost identical to this, naked and all, named Yeriko. So Yeriko nurses Inkle to health and brings him gifts. He's sort of in this cave and they're langering together and, you know, all that. So eventually, Inkle and Yeriko decide to leave together to presumably make a life. And here, I quote from the 1711 text. "Mr. Thomas Inkle, now coming into English territories," they go to Barbados, incidentally, "began seriously to reflect upon his loss of time and to weigh with himself how many days' interest of his money he had lost during his stay with Yeriko. This thought made the young man very pensive and careful what account he should be able to give his friends of the voyage. Upon which considerations, the prudent and frugal young man sold Yeriko to a Barbadian merchant. Notwithstanding that the poor girl, to incline him to commiserate her condition, told him that she was with child by him. But he only made use of this information to rise in his demands upon the purchaser." So, How appropriate. So this displacement of slavery from black bodies to an Indian body obscures the reality of the transatlantic slave trade. However, the widespread popularity of the story, and it was indeed one of the most popular stories of the 18th century, it became an opera. It became a pantomime, weirdly, if you can imagine. So the widespread popularity of the story throughout the century suggests that it represented, in part, the dangers of the merchant class, and also addressed the deep misgivings that many in Britain felt over the expansion of trade and empire. New desires could corrupt the soul. So, to end, while this is unmistakably a monument to empire, or at least to a fantasy of an empire to come, the Indian, reflecting both menace and subservience, both masks and reflects its deep ambiguities and moral misgivings.
You've been listening to Robbie Richardson present on North American Indians and the British Modernity, as part of the Counter Speculations audio tour.
To hear other recordings or to learn more, please visit www.ucl.ac.uk/urbanlab.